News today that the president of parts of Borneo in a small hut near his cousin, Lenny Spelmorth, who sells carpets at outrageously cheap prices and once had an extramarital affair with a three-toed sloth named Petunia Wink, Yeraldim Spehefi Heffi, has been caught in a gummy hamster smuggling racket off the coast of one of the less affluent islands in the Maldives. Several of his cabinet, most of whom are ungulates with impeccable tastes in cravats and pointy nasal attachments, rushed to his aid and have started systematically hushing the whole thing up. One of them, a particularly prominently buttocked Spanish Ibex, accused the media of fabricating the story to take attention away from the fact that most of the world is in utter chaos and we teeter on the brink of complete self-annihilation due to stupidity and pride, probably in the next 5 years. The world media replied, "Don't be ridiculous," yelled, "Wait, what's that shiny thing over there?" and made their escape through the thick jungle overgrowth to the ancient city of Tucumbicumbi, which had been presumed lost for decades, but it turns out that the Kaktak tribe, who generally rule the place, are incredibly sensible and find other humans at best an annoyance and at their worst, downright hateful and punchworthy. In other headlines, Fermi Wormguttle, Latin minister for tossing it in his neighbour's yard, has opened a string of successful haberdasheries where not only can you buy nifty coloured zips and a myriad of thimble types, but you can also, if you choose, have your genitals rubbed liberally with lemon loaf by a dwarf named Simon. And in other headlines, celebrity chef and downright arrogant facial stomach, Carlos Cachifachu Pomsgrade, ate a bat. But now, unfortunately, it's the after-movie diner, which this week comes all the way from the Jocelyn Fez, bring a ladle full of pudding and a picture of your uncle's taint eatery in fashionable West London. The special today is endives dipped in the vague and tiresome disgust of a relative you don't see frequently enough, and pigeons sautéed in the tears of the goat that once held a special place in the heart of toothy wonderkind and well-known lover of hats, Carly Simon. For 40 pence in old teeth, the waiters will perform a hearty jig while trying to maintain trouser pockets filled with gazpacho soup, and for 60 pence, the maitre d' will come over and tell them to stop it.
You're listening to the After Movie Diner with your host, John Cross.
That's right, I am John Cross, and while you may have to deal with my voice, I have to deal with my thighs, wrists, and face. So do all the children. Hello, ladies, germs, wickens, wockens, toucans, youcans, haves, have-nots, have-a-goes, have-a-banana, people who believe in a dog's right to protest, a goat's right to party, and a Belgian gut sparrow to do the mashed potato, hat-lovers, fat-mothers, chat-feathers, hearty glands, Barry Manilow fans, admirers of spaghetti hoops, owners of one-legged parakeets named George, and the made-up Prime Minister of Lithuania, Herb Velmpants. Welcome one and welcome all. Before we get started with this week's show, a reminder that you can support the podcast over at patreon.com/aftermoviediner. That's patreon.com/aftermoviediner. And not only get some great rewards, but get the personal reward of knowing you paid it forward once. You can then smugly lord your goodness over all your friends at your next monthly wine, cheese, and pygmy cuddling festival. You can also go to aftermoviediner.com and click on the Amazon link in the top right-hand corner before you do any of your Amazon shopping. It costs you absolutely no extra, but for everything you buy, Amazon kicks us a few shiny coins. Alternatively, you can also copy and paste that link and bookmark it as your Amazon link so that every time you go, it's as if you're clicking through the website without having to go to the website. But go to the website because it's full of awesome content by incredible contributors. Anyway, finally, you can also go to miskplumbingfixtures.bandcamp.com. That's M-I-S-C, plumbingfixtures.bandcamp.com, and buy some singer-songwritery, folky, bluesy, rocky music by Miscellaneous Plumbing Fixtures. Every penny goes back to keeping aftermoviediner.com and this podcast alive. So please help us out wherever you can, and if you can't, we all understand we get strapped for cash. At least rate and review us wherever the podcast is found and help spread the word. And now, as if with a magic flash, we're off to the diner. All right, hello and welcome. We are back, ladies and germs.
Backington.
Okay.
That's the new word, sweeping New York.
It is.
Sweeping it.
Good evening, ladies and germs, and Gerald Backerton III. We are back, Backington, here in the After Movie Diner.
But not in this diner, because we've never been here before.
But
I tried to suggest that maybe we had, and you got quite cross about it.
I didn't get quite cross
not
about
quite
it.
Cross.
I got John Cross about it.
You got John Cross about it. Because you do get John Cross about some things.
I get John Cross about most things.
Yeah, you just got John Cross about 2001 A Space Odyssey outside.
I did, yeah.
But you got quite John Cross about that.
I did.
Can we start with the whole cross pun? Because it's really...
I quite like it.
I feel like this in my 38th year, it's sort of overdone. It's overcooked.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. I think people have heard it, mate. Well, they've been there, they've done that. Unlike this diner, where they haven't.
Oh, all right. I've never made a John Cross thing before.
Well, you might not.
I feel like I'm late to the party.
Yeah,
not
you
that it was pretty... Clearly, it was a pretty horrible party.
It's not a great party. It's almost like a party that you hold filled with hope and dreams of a party filled with fascinating, interesting, you know, lovely people.
Right.
And when you actually throw the party, three people you kind of don't like and just invited out of politeness and sheer desperation show up.
And that's it.
And then tell you everything that's going wrong with your life.
That sounds like, you know, like it started off like as a hypothetical, but then it got like really super specific to a sense that you were actually having a flashback. Your equivalent of a Vietnam flashback.
Yeah.
Only instead of like Choppers in the Jungle. Choppers in the Jungle. It was three blokes at a party. I want the corned beef omelet, I think is what I want.
Do I want ham, egg and fries, or do I want a chicken parmesan sandwich? I think I want just
chili
ham, egg,
and cheddar
fries.
Cheese on it. Do they think they mean chili as in...
That'd be chili as in, like, you know...
No, it'll be an actual chili, won't it?
Like meat chili. You always go for omelette. I always find that to be completely weird.
Don't you think you want a chili and cheddar cheese omelette? That sounds amazing.
Well, then order it. You big goof. You big goon. You big wazza. You big dribbly mass.
You
big Kolchak the Night Stalker.
I realise that now. That hat is particularly Kolchak. All I need is like a really cheap
blue jacket.
I feel like this is his shirt too.
Right, yeah, you just need a light blue jacket and that thing he has around his neck.
Okay, deal. Do you think that just a corned beef omelette is going to be too dry?
I can't make these life decisions for you.
Am I either going to get the corned beef omelette or
for God's sake.
the chili and cheddar cheese omelette?
These are the things that will haunt us still.
I think I might get the chili. I'm going to find out if it's chili as in, you know, I don't want to look at you like cheddar cheese and like, you know, spicy hot chilies.
Well, you're going to ask him the difference. This is going to take forever.
It's not, he's just going to say yes or no.
He's not going to understand what you're saying.
The chili and cheddar cheese omelette. Chili, is that like chili bowl of chili? Or chili as in, you know, the...
No, this is the chili.
That's the chili, okay. So I'll get the chili and cheddar cheese on that.
Chili and cheddar, okay.
Thank you very much. Whole wheat toast, please.
I have two eggs, over easy, with the ham, fried, and I'll have fries. No, regular fries.
No home fries for me.
No potatoes.
No, just a toast, isn't it?
No potatoes.
No potatoes.
White toast or white toast for you?
White toast, please.
White toast, okay. So over ham, french fries, and white toast.
Two eggs, ham, french fries, white toast.
Over, eh? Over.
The eggs over easy, yeah. I'll actually grab a... Can I grab an ice cold can of Coke? That'd be amazing.
Coke and a Coke?
Can of Coke, yeah. The lovely iced cold can of Coke.
For you?
I'm going to go the opposite. I'm going to get English breakfast tea with milk, please. Thank you very much.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
So,
here we are, about to get our omelettes, chili and cheddar cheese. Now I feel like I should have got a corned beef omelette. But who can turn down a chili and cheddar cheese omelette?
I'm
really
going to smack you violently in the face if you don't be quiet about fucking omelettes.
I have to say, like...
Nobody cares about your omelettes.
Can I ask a question? Do you feel like the hot weather makes you more or less grumpy? I'm just wondering, do you know what I mean?
Way
more. Because it's a mystery to me.
Way more
whether
grumpy.
You're more grumpy. It was so disgusting today.
Yeah.
That I've,
we walked
I,
for an hour
I
in it, though.
I swear blind.
We walked for an hour
we
in it.
We did work for an hour. You said potato or potatoes? No potatoes. Yeah, just hold the test. Thanks, mate.
We walked for an hour in it, and then to get to the diner after the movie, we walked for another 20
minutes. But it was disgusting as soon as we started. It wasn't like after an hour.
Well, that's what I said. So I walked,
as soon as we started,
I walked
horrible.
Over. Nobody cares about this, by the way, but I walked over from Madison to 7th or whatever avenue you're on. Yeah. And I was already at the maximum point of smegginess that I could be. So I just figured, if we continue to walk, how much more, like, smells could I attach to my already disgusting
frame?
They
turn out quite a few.
Quite a few.
Certainly when
apparently, if you walk an hour through Midtown, the West Village, and eventually Tribeca, you will develop inhuman levels of smell.
There was a point in the movie, and I'm not kidding. Yeah. I moved my arm to like get something, and I nearly passed out.
Because, because of
all of a sudden, out of nowhere,
what came out from under your arm.
It came out from under my arm.
You know how you feel.
There.
You know how you feel like that in the middle of the movie. You know how you had that experience. That's almost everyone else's experience with you every day. That's not true, ladies and gents. He's lovely. Thank you very much. I'm only jesting.
He's only pulling me legs. He's only pulling me legs.
Yanking the crank. Tugging your sailboat.
Not for the first time.
I don't know. Tugging your sailboat. I don't even know what that is. Oh, that looks amazing. Thanks, sir. So, the After Movie Diner this week is coming from the Washington Square Diner.
Rat adjacent. It comes in its own garden and its own rat.
Well, there is a small city park to the left of it where I'm sitting, to the right of it if you're facing it. Again, nobody really cares. And in that park, there be a rat and much garbage.
Presumably, like king rat of that
king
park.
Rat of that
he was
park.
just like wandering around the middle of the park without a care in the world.
Also, there's a potted plant in the window that appears to still have Christmas decorations on it.
It does seem to.
Unless they just thought it was pretty bows and didn't realise.
Maybe the rat likes it. You know what I mean,
well, maybe
they took him down and then the rat knocked on the window. And went, what are you doing?
Oh wow!
What are you doing?
And a guy just came through from the kitchen and carrying an enormous bag of garbage. Through the restaurant. But literally from the kitchen to the front.
Cool.
So instead of taking it round the back or to some sort of
probably the rat's
on
the back. Do you know what I mean? They probably haven't paid like the rat tax.
So anyway, that's where we are. This gets 4 stars out of 386 reviews. And it is deemed an A.
384 of them were written by rats.
It's deemed an A by the New York City inspectors, most of whom as well, I would assume, are rats. Probably several rats in a trench coat and a hat pretending to be a human.
Honestly.
And they're like, wait a minute, your face there, that looks a bit ratty.
Yeah.
He's like, well, yeah.
Look a little bit like a whole bunch of rats.
I've been ill.
Covered in an overcoat.
Covered in an overcoat.
Squeak. Oh, wow.
I'll step away. But anyway, yeah, so the After Movie Diner is a brand new diner this week. It was either this or one that we've been to many times before, which...
And we know how much they care.
It's fine.
They get so bored if we just go to the same old diner.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's deeply important to them that we go to a new diner.
Well, it's deeply important to me, mate.
I don't know.
Or we could have gone across the road to the Waverly Diner.
Desperately clinging on to the idea of, like, that there could be such a thing as a new experience.
Well, this is a new experience.
As opposed to rehashing the same old experiences.
You know, these tiny awkward benches and the rat adjacent...
Slow but definite march towards the grave.
Well, if...
The ever-decreasing circles.
If I'm grumpy...
are our lives.
If I'm grumpy... You're clearly cheery.
I guess, in an
ironic way. Like, if you were going to have... If you were going to have Snow White and the Seven Ironic Dwarfs...
No, I would be Irony the Dwarf.
You would be cheery.
I would be Irony the Dwarf. Like, well, this is great. Oh, yeah, yeah, let's wake her up. Yeah, brilliant. <That's it. laughs> Sarky the Dwarf.
Yeah.
That would be...
Well, no, because then that's not ironic. It would have to be... You would have to be called, like, Pleasantries the Dwarf or something when really...
I could be Pleasantries the Dwarf.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Lovely. Cool.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much. Lovely.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, yeah. Hold it for me, yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. Magic.
Wow, that literally is...
That is exactly what it says on the tin.
Chili poured all over an omelette.
I feel like this is going to kill me. I feel like I'm going to die.
I have to say, dear listeners, that it is quite grotesque what we're looking at right now.
It all depends on the definition of grotesque.
Well, I tell you how I define grotesque. Something that looks like... It may have, I can't even say it. I think if I say it, it'll put you off your grotesque.
Yeah, no, don't. Because actually does look pretty good to me.
But we have an announcement. Really? We have an announcement before we kick in.
Do we?
Yeah, we do. I've just got to bring it up on the old telephone system. So the announcement then this week is a huge thank you.
Oh, cool.
From Jim and myself.
Oh, yeah.
To a Mr. Charles H. Nelson.
Cool, Charles H. Nelson.
For his new patronising of us through Patreon to the tune of $1 a show.
Charles H. Nelson, you're a gentleman and a scholar.
He's off your shit list.
He is off my shit list.
I think he heard your...
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you, Charles Charles H. Nelson. It's a splendid name, a strong name.
Strong name.
And a second huge thank you, because between recording this episode and editing this episode, Chris Leatherman also donated on Patreon to the After Movie Diner. So a huge, huge thank you to those two chaps. Thanks so much for your support of the After Movie Diner. How fantastic. Please do keep it up. And we will keep it up. Huh? See what I did there? Good. Now back to the show.
And anyway, tonight... prior to sitting down in the
Washington Square Diner,
We went to the Roxy Cinema, which is...
Well, we are lifetime members.
We are now lifetime members, thanks to this very podcast. So, really, we should say, tonight's episode is sponsored by the Roxy Cinema, Tribeca. If ever in New York and you want to see either a retro show or a new, interesting, different movie... Or catch a jazz band in an old-fashioned, groovy, big red velvet curtain type
air conditioned.
Key.
That was very, very important today.
Old school cinema.
I was a bit worried about
that. Running. Also screens 35mm.
It was good quality.
Very good quality. We can highly recommend the Roxy Cinema Tribeca. Reopened recently, I believe.
Yes.
After some renovations. But they're not renovations you would know. You wouldn't go in and go, ugh, this has been made all modern and ugh. This is in keeping with the swanky New York Tribeca thing. But it's very reasonable. Even if you do have to pay, it's not your $16,
$17, $18. $12. $12. That's really nice too.
And you see a good movie. And thanks to the Roxy Cinema, they heard our shows. They saw our posts on the Instagrams. And they extended a hand of unity to the afternoon.
A hand of unity holding a box of popcorn.
And so I think the Roxy Tribeca Cinema, probably one of my new favourites.
Yes, I would absolutely agree with that, particularly as the films we've shown there, we've seen there, have been really good.
Yeah, now there was a slight...
Except for Gander and Hess, which was just weird.
It was not good. No, there was a slight dearth of Thursday evening screenings.
Yes.
But back with a bang, 7 p.m., right in the sweet spot, right where we need it to be.
Yes.
We saw a screening of 1951's... It purports to be a film noir. It's actually probably more like a melodrama, to be honest.
This is more like a thriller. I'd say it's like an old-fashioned thriller.
Right.
If they made it in Hollywood now, you'd describe that as a thriller, not a melodrama.
Starring... Robert Ryan, which people will know from The Dirty Dozen and The Wild Bunch, one of the few people to actually appear in both. You'll also know him from a whole bunch of other stuff if you are a golden era of Hollywood aficionado. But he worked for decades, right into the 70s. Usually playing hard-bitten cops and or criminals.
Right.
And or army types, because he has got quite the...
He's got like a captain's face, isn't he? I could see him as being like a captain, an American army captain.
The grizzled and chiseled.
Like authority, but not right at the top.
Grizzled and chiseled. Not grizzled and chiseled bollocks, mate.
And the problem with a white shirt is when you drop...
You just drop fucking chilli on it.
You drop chilli cheese on it.
Oh.
It's not going to forgive you for that. I'm going to have to spend the rest of the day in New York with a chilli cheese stain.
Looking like you pooped the front of your shirt.
you know, I don't want to wander around looking like a middle-aged man, but just sometimes that's just what's going to happen to me, isn't it?
It's just going to happen, mate. And you don't even have children.
Can't fight it. Can't fight it.
So Robert Ryan and Ida Lupino.
I think it's Ida Lupino.
Ida Lupino.
Oh, I'd heard of it. I don't think I've seen her anymore.
I've got a feeling she became something of a auteur, didn't she? Didn't she, like, direct some stuff and...
I haven't got a clue. Your name is familiar. But more than that, mate, I cannot.
I have to say, we are still dipping one's pinkies into the murky film noir
I'd like to see a lot more of
Hollywood.
I've only seen the...
Waters.
We talked about this when we went to see...
Sunset Boulevard.
About how I'd always thought, I was like, yeah, you know, I've seen it. But actually, I've only seen, you know, The Big Sleep, Maltese Falcon, Casablanca.
Right.
The classics.
So the more the Roxy puts on such things...
The more we'll go and see him.
The more we'll go see him. Film noir, mate, that's where it's at.
Absolutely.
Baby. As I believe Robert Ryan himself would have said.
But you're right. Although there were
if he had but the words.
So shall I go run down the plot?
Yeah, go ahead, mate.
The plot is Robert Ryan is a New York City cop. Is it New York?
It's never stated what city.
No, because they drive 70 miles north of New York is not mountains. Is
no. It's an unnamed city.
Unnamed city. He's a cop in an unnamed, dirty city. Yeah, because the addresses were kind of weird, too.
Yeah.
But, and he is the only single copper in his mini unit. He's sick of the life.
He's been doing it 12 years.
He's doing it 11. 11 years.
11 years?
11 years.
Okay.
This is his 12th, I suppose. And he's sick of it, and he's been drawn into the muck.
Well, he starts off something of a Dirty Harry figure.
No, I don't.
Or like a proto Dirty Harry, in the sense that...
I guess so, yeah.
In the sense that his go-to stance is rough him up and get the business on him, but...
I mean, it's a bit more complicated than that.
No, it is.
But I know what you mean.
Unlike Harry... He wrestles with it. He doesn't understand why he has to do it.
He's having a crisis of faith, basically. But it involves the fact that all he sees, he's been the bigger cop, like sums up. He says, you know, all
pop.
Right. All he sees are people who have an angle, who are trying to play him. And he doesn't really connect with anybody. He doesn't really know why he's doing what he's doing.
And he doesn't.
He doesn't understand why.
He doesn't go home to anyone.
No, he doesn't go home to anyone. And he doesn't understand why he has to be brutal. In other words, in order to get the information that he needs, that people want him to get as a cop, he has to be like a thug and brutal. And like that, there is that amazing scene with the guy where he says, "Why do you make me do it? You know you're going to talk. I know you're going to talk. So why do you make me beat you up?"
Yeah.
And then he does it anyway and puts him in the hospital. And the lawyer wants a word. So he basically goes too far. He doesn't exactly snap. It's just that he stops caring about the niceties of, you know, like, you know, punching where they don't bruise and stuff like that. He doesn't even care about that anymore. Like, all he knows is I have to beat him up until he talks. He doesn't give a shit about consequences anymore. He stopped caring about consequences. He's going through the motions, the extremely violent motions. And so,
he's not even interested in any human kindness, because we see a couple of women in the first sort of section of the film make eyes at him or try and be nice to him or try and like...
Well, there's two. There's the blonde who he... The insinuation is he does have it away with the blonde.
Right.
In order to get the information, and then kind of leaves feeling dead inside, because basically he's just like, had sex with a woman for her information, which is pretty bleak. And then there's the sweet girl at the
ice cream gun,
who says, yeah, what would my brother say, my, you know, going out with a cop? It's like disdain for the idea of her ever actually dating a policeman, despite the fact that she's flirting with them. And that really... that pushes him over the edge, I think, this idea that he's doing all this stuff and people despise him.
Right.
Even the people he's protecting. I mean, he's despised by the criminals, but he understands that. But he's despised by the people that he's, like, you know, ruining himself for.
Right.
So his captain sends him on a case upstate where some girl's been murdered. The timeline doesn't really make sense about that, because some girl's been murdered, but by the time he gets up there, they found the guy that's done it, and they're chasing him. And it all seems to have happened, like, just hours before.
Right.
But whatever. And anyway, he joins in this, like, long chase of this guy who's killed.
Yeah.
That guy's daughter. And they chase him, and they chase him, and he's chasing him with this guy. And the guy's like, yeah, you're just a city cop. You're just going to get in the way with your rules, when all I'm going to do when I find him is blow his fucking brains out. Not realising that the city cop goes, nope, that sounds fine to me. Chase, you know, where we get to kill someone with no moral consequences, but there's a right and a wrong. I'm comfortable with that.
I don't know that that's what he's saying. I read that differently. But anyway, carry
fair
on.
Fair enough. Either way, he seemed to be relieved to be involved in a chase where he's not going to have to beat anybody up. He just has to chase somebody. And it's more like, it's fine if you want to, you know, if you want to do it, I don't give a shit. It's basically his stance seems to be. And,
again, I don't think so, but carry on.
All right, fair enough. Anyway, they eventually follow him to this house. And in the house is a blind woman who, it's apparent pretty early on, is hiding the guy, whoever it is. And then they find, like, men's clothes in the house. And she goes, well, they're my brothers. So it's pretty obvious that the man they're looking for is her brother. And in the over the course of the night, it all happens in this quite, you know, it all happens basically over the course of a night.
Yeah.
And they stay at this house. And in the morning, like, basically the chase begins again. But over the course of the night, he makes sort of a connection with the woman because she doesn't need him, but also she sort of does. And that's sort of the connection. She's proud.
See, I don't... Okay.
We're gone.
But I mean, yeah, they're the basic beats in the movie.
All right.
Sure.
All right. Go on, then disagree with me. Razor-sharp analysis. My Reading University approved film analysis.
Yeah, well, that says it all, doesn't it, dear listener? Because, of course, Wickham or Buckinghamshire Chiltern's University is so much better.
But as far as the Yanks are concerned, Chiltern University, Reading University, it's all the same, isn't it?
Right.
It's not as if Reading's like the fucking acme of anything, except being Reading. And even that, there's probably another Reading somewhere in the world that's better at being Reading than Reading is.
Oh, yeah, I mean, yes, for definite. For definite. It's going to be difficult to kind of unpack, because I was sort of thinking about it when I was watching the movie.
Yes, I really liked it.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I mean, it's... One thing that's a little obvious, I felt, was it's by no means a big-budget movie.
No, that's true.
Although
they've got Bernard Herrmann to do the music. But that's pre-Psycho, right? 51 is like 10 years, so maybe he's not.
Yeah, plus he's kind of done scores for all different types of movies. But interesting that he does this and he also does Taxi Driver. Because there's definitely he does Taxi Driver, right?
Yeah.
Because there's definitely a sort of God's Lonely Man aspect to...
Quick take.
Well, it's difficult to do a quick take for this movie, because I feel like there's a lot more going on.
Cross take, TM.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Like a new segment of the diner called cross take.
Cross take. All right, do a little theme and I'll do cross take.
Cross take, cross take. What is the cross take? Probably a bit grumpy, but it's still cross take.
Yeah, I would have preferred something a bit more snap. That was a bit like...
A bit too long?
Sing song. Yeah. I wanted more like...
Cross take.
Like a short burst of cross take.
Got it.
I think the opening bit has a lot of... And of course, you know, you'd have to watch tons of more movies to kind of necessarily establish this. But it had a lot of, like, proto things that would sort of be done again much later on in the 70s and 80s in terms of
It was very straight ahead, wasn't it?
No, but in terms of sort of, in terms of the sort of esoteric drama that on the surface is about, well, not even on the surface in this movie, because I feel like it's fairly obvious what they're trying to say about his condition and his mindset and his personality and his soul and everything. But it's not like if you go in expecting a straight police drama or even a straight country chase movie or even a, you know, a detective falls in love with a country blind woman girl kind of movie. It's not that at all. It's basic beats, but there's a couple of interesting things. The first interesting thing is when Pop the cop, who has the bad shoulder, says to him, like, you know, you don't go home to anyone, and, you know, why are you being so violent in this whole life, and da 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 da. The way the movie starts up, where you see the other two and their lives, and Pop has a house full of children, and his other partner has like a woman who doesn't want him to go out on the night
shift. That bit where she puts his holster on him, and the movie opens with this wife putting the gun holster on her, like as if she's like helping him out on his way. Well, she is helping him out on his way to work.
Yeah,
and then she like holds him after she's fastened it. That was an amazing bit, like an amazing scene. And you've got no idea what's going on. You've got no frame of reference to that.
No frame of reference.
He's like, why do you have to go? Why do you have to go? You don't know, like, is he a hitman? Like, what the fuck is going on here? It was really, and then just to, like, he's just off to work. But and the beeping on the, yeah, it's great.
It's very straightforward. It's not stylized. It's trying for realism, even though it's like clearly a probably medium to low budget Hollywood film noir at the time. But it gives you little, but that whole thing about his shoulder and he's digging and they have to go to the drugstore and the doctor is going to help him out, and
was based on a novel,
right?
That I saw. So things like that's why I think it feels a little richer,
right?
And like,
but it's two movies. Like the whole opening section could like be its own movie. And the idea that like all of a sudden, literally within the course of a day, he's gone from chasing thugs down and beating them up on the streets of an unnamed crime-ridden city to like running through the snow upstate. It's sort of quite jarring. And there's so much to unpack, and I really don't feel like I'm doing it justice. The scene where he is with the criminal in the beginning of the movie, and
those are very film noir shots when they burst in on the guy in the hotel room.
Yeah,
there's like that bit where he's like in the chair in this like almost like 20s expressionist like pose of like horror,
right?
In between the two.
And that's
cops.
Why I said but melodrama, because the acting was very melodramatic and not.
Well, no, I mean he was, and the woman, the woman was very film noir. He was like, there was like moments of being obviously film noir about it, like.
But it didn't have the patter of like
No,
it had like a very
but the
sullen,
look,
straight.
But the look of him in between the two cops, it looked almost like a picture out of a out of a Reading University film book on film noir.
I get that. No, I just mean,
well, he did what
to almost
Nicholas
say.
Nicholas Ray did other stuff, right? He did some other famous movies.
But I think they're filming it that way to say, this is a film noir, you know the tropes, here we go, black and white, lots of shadow, da-da-da, it's a cop drama. But then all of a sudden, you're following this cop where everyone, even his partners, are questioning, like, you don't care about anyone, do you?
Yeah.
Nobody likes him, and nobody gets him, and nobody really understands
him. He's like a Marlowe figure, of like, he's, you know, a lonesome knight who's an honourable man in a world of scoundrels kind of thing. He's a scoundrel in a world of scoundrels.
Right, except the only thing that gives him some honour, and the only reason why I kind of disagree that he shows up north and is just like, yeah, whatever, because I don't really think he's... I think that the way he plays him, and a little bit of the way it's written, not only is he clearly, like, he's clearly got to a point where he's not only hating what he's doing, but he's questioning how he got to that point. And he's also questioning, like, why he's even forced to continue to do it. And it's not that Robert Ryan does anything particularly amazing, but there's something...
He's pretty good.
No, no, he is.
He bounces from, good. Like, thing to thing pretty effortlessly.
But he has something underneath his sternness and his cruelty. And there's a couple of little shots and little, like, motions he does with his body that makes you know he's not the bad egg. That makes him
That's true. I'm sorry.
Redemption to be had in there. And actually, the person holding him back from that redemption is him. Like, normally in a movie, I guess, it would be the external forces, like you say. There would be this very good guy who's forced to do a few bad things because of the scenarios around him.
Yeah.
What this explores, and it's more interesting, is that actually the thing that is holding him back is him. And then when he meets Ida Lupino, this blind woman who's living in this house with her brother, who she indicates probably needs to be in a mental health ward.
But then we found out she gave up her sight to protect, because she said something. Her brother was explaining, he said that she had a chance to go away and get her sight fixed.
Yeah.
But that she didn't want to leave him on his own because he would get into trouble.
Right, because clearly the son, the younger brother, and
So I guess, like him,
he is but a boy.
She gave everything.
Yeah.
To a hopeless cause.
Right.
Like, the brother is a hopeless cause. She knew it. Just like him trying to clean the streets up.
Right.
Is a hopeless cause, and he knows it. And they're kind of alone and struggling with that notion of having sacrificed, you know, a huge part of themselves.
Right.
To do something that they don't really believe in.
But there's also two things. There's...
like duty, I guess.
Right.
To some extent.
There's... the fact that he is in the big city and feels very alone.
Yes.
But she's in the middle of countryside, can't see anything, and has not given in to her loneliness.
Yeah.
She's aware that she is alone, but she is not lonely. She's also aware of the kind of futility of her situation, but she's also not letting her bring her down. And when he initially meets her, there's the interesting sequence where she's like, oh, I would have thought, and it's like, to even think to write this is what I love about this.
Yeah.
There's a very simple scene. She goes to get him tea, and she's like, clearly has like touchstones in her living room, how she knows how to go to the kitchen and come back and whatever. She brings the tray out, puts the tray down, and hands him his cup and saucer. And he sits down, and she says, you must have been around other blind people before. You didn't like condescend to me, you didn't sympathize with me, you didn't like take the tray off me and make the tea yourself. You let me do it for you and hand you a cup. That's most unusual. And what that's meant to say is that he didn't even think about it. He didn't even think about helping her. Like, he's got to the point where this is just another scenario for him. He feels like he can't beat it out of her, but he knows that she's got something to say.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because there is that really cool, definite, deliberate juxtaposition. There's that point where he knows that she knows something. Right? We know she knows something. And all he knows how to do is, up to this point, is sleep with her, like he did with the blonde woman to get information.
Yeah.
Or beat the information. And he can't do either. And so he's a bit... He seems to be pleased to be free from these options.
Right. But this... his stoicism is almost a plus to her.
Right.
At that point, I think it becomes not so much, but at that point it is. And then it becomes even more a tragedy, which is she pleads with him. She says, I will give up my brother. I will give up the guy that I've, you know, given my sight and everything for. If you promise, beyond everything, not to hurt him. You can take him away, put him in the psych ward, whatever. But, like, no one can hurt him. And she says this to him while the father of the dead girl that the brother killed is outside with a shotgun just aching to shoot anyone in the face.
Right.
there's suddenly this scenario, and I thought about this while the movie was on. I'm going to have difficulty trying to recreate the thoughts, but she basically puts him in a position. Oh, damn it. I wish I could think what I was thinking when I was watching the movie. I had it all, like, in my head, how, like, all the pieces fit together.
Well, she mentions, I know, that there's a hint that something could have been done about him a long time ago. Because
yeah, she confronts him with his loneliness.
No. As in, he says, they'll take him away somewhere safe. And she says, yeah, now that it's too late. In other words, there's some story there about...
Yeah, no, I wasn't even thinking
that. No, I know. I was talking about something to get the old, cross take together.
Yeah.
Cross takes are never easy things.
No, it's not.
You can't rush them.
No.
They've got to be sewn together, constructed. They have.
Over time. And
brick
I'll figure
by
it out.
Brick.
But it was to do with the... At that moment where she's pleading with him, that's the pivotal moment. Like, that's the moment for him where he's going to help instead of her.
Yeah.
But...
Thank you very much.
It comes out of...
Yeah, because he's just... Because that's the great bit, because there's the bit where she's saying, please say you will. Please say you won't hurt him. Promise me. And he's thinking about it. You can see on his face, he's really, really thinking about it. But, of course, she can't... All she hears is just silence to her. So she's... Because she thinks this is... there's a part of this, like, this is a no-brainer, right? I'm going to give it to my brother, and you're a cop, so just promise me he won't get hurt, right? That's a no-brainer for a cop. But
right.
Given well, everything he's been through, he really, really has to think about it. So when he says... No, he won't be hurt as long as he's with me. That's all I can promise.
Right.
That's a real... He means that. He really means it.
But it also goes back to... You said he sort of showed up north. He doesn't really care. When he first goes up north and goes into the farmhouse where the family of the slain girl are before the father shows up, he's trying to ask her questions. Like, he's trying to be a cop and, like, figure stuff out. Like, I think there's some indication that he is a good cop and he does know what to do, and it's not just about him beating people up. He feels that his hand has been forced to beat people up.
He's not Russell Crowe in LA Confidential.
No, he's a good cop, and so he goes in to start asking questions, and immediately everyone's like, stop asking her questions, nobody cares about questions. And he's suddenly in this place where he's confronted, I guess, with the father of the family as a representation of the way that everyone else thinks he is.
Right.
Everyone else thinks he is just a whatever, punch him in the face, knock him on the floor.
No, I think they think he's going to get in the way with his rules and regulations, and they just want revenge.
No, that's what the father's saying. I'm saying that Robert Ryan, the cop, Jim Wilson,
right,
that character, is suddenly confronted with someone who... Yes, because he lost his daughter, but in general, it's just like, no, fuck everyone else. No one else gets to shoot him. I get to shoot him in the gut. That's me. That's what I'm doing. I'm on a single course of revenge about this. And I think he's more aware of the violence of that and the moral problem with that.
Right.
I think everyone else around him.
So in other words, like the thing that he's struggling with, everything in the city is like a moral grey area. Right. It's like, we need the information, so we do need you to hit them, but just a bit.
Right.
You just hit them a bit. Don't get carried away.
Right.
Just hit them enough for the information. And it's like, well, that's not a black and white. Like, that's it's just, his whole life is grey.
Right.
It's just grey people with grey motives and grey. It's just all
the
big grey area.
But my other point is that no one around him, I mean, one of them goes, like, you have to talk, you can't not talk at some point. But no one around him has bothered to, like, really engage him, or they just think he's, like, this bad guy.
Right.
But then suddenly he's confronted with someone who is black and white. There is no moral quandary for him.
He's right, at that point in the movie, there's evil,
right?
Someone that's killed a kid, right? Evil,
and I feel
let's
like
go after the evil and kill it.
And I feel like the sequence where
maybe that's a bit of a relief.
But I feel like the sequence where they're in the car, And the father is like, you're going to lose him. It's your fault we've lost him. Why wouldn't you do, that? And Robert Ryan is like trying to be more level-headed and trying to be more sensible. I think that's all there to show us that he's not just the wham-bam, couldn't care less, rogue, Dirty Harry type. He's actually more thoughtful, intelligent policeman.
Although maybe there's a thing about this particular sequence. Like you're saying that, I mean, when he talks to the girl at the beginning, when he goes into the house, he's talking to the sister. He's going through the motions. He's like, what are you talking, like, she's told everybody. Like, we know who it is. You know, and he's like, what? And he's just like being a cop, asking the questions. That's what he does. He goes in here. But he's going, and there's no.
But he also doesn't know. He turns up, and the whole town is out for blood.
What I'm saying is, there's obviously no sensitivity within him to like the situation of what that girl's been through, what the family's been through.
No, okay,
he's like,
no.
And I'm not saying he's like being insensitive. It's just like he's just like matter of fact about
doing
his
job.
You know, it's like, I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know what all this is. And I think that bit when he gets in the car with the cop and he's driving off and everything is, at that point, like you say, black and white, I think that comes as something of a relief to him. And he's like, yeah, I'm up for the chase, let's go. And because I think he is at the beginning. He's like, he's up for it, let's go. You know, because he like smiles. He's like, you're going to be a city cop, you're going to get in the way. And he kind of smiles at him. Like just before they get in the car, like, you don't have to worry about me, mate. I'm all fucking in on this, right? And I think as it goes on, and the guy's being more and more unreasonable, like, put your foot down. I can't put my foot down anymore. I'm going as fast as I can.
Right.
Or we're going to slip off the road or whatever. And it's just like, failure. And he, because the guy next to him is like totally irrational.
Right.
Like, I don't care that there's, you know, that the road is icy. I don't care this car is slow. All I know is he's there and he's getting away.
Right.
And I don't know anything else except that.
Right.
And so he's kind of forced to sit. What I'm saying is, he's forced to spend what seemed like, you know, an hour or maybe even more in a car with his own, like a reflection of his own, like, illogical fury. You know, like the fury that overtakes him when he beats up that suspect in the hotel room. Like just furious illogic, you know, at how illogical the situation is. Just furious. He's forced to spend time with that. And the more he is, the more he realizes how futile it is.
Right.
You know, and that's why when he arrives at the farmhouse, he's already, as it were, before he even meets her, like done, like realized a significant amount of that.
Right.
The After Movie Diner with John Cross will return right after this.
Your guide to cinema etiquette from the Countdown Movie and TV Reviews podcast. Question 17. When choosing a seat at a largely empty movie cinema, do you...
A. Sit directly in front of another person. B. Sit right alongside a couple clearly enamored with one another. Or C. Take a seat away from other patrons that afford you a good view. If you answered A or B, fuck you!
For more useful cinema etiquette, join Paul and Wayne on the Countdown Movie and TV Reviews podcast at Podomatic on iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
Good morning. Are you single and ready to mingle? Well, you're in luck because you can find your match by listening to the greatest podcast on earth, and it's
called the Poop Culture Podcast.
Visit us at www.poopculture.com.
Poop culture, yeah, poop culture, poop culture, yeah, it's a poop culture.
Poop culture, it's culture shock. Listen in, it'll make the world rock. Laugh and cry and cringe and bust with a mad cry.
Poop culture. Yeah, yeah, poop culture. Poop, 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 poop culture. Yeah, it's the poop culture.
You're listening to the sweet sounds of the After Movie Diner. Support us at patreon.com/AfterMovieDiner. Or I'll punch you in the teats. Rate and review us on iTunes, Earthling.
So then there's the scenario that she gives him, I'm going to give up your brother, my brother, for you, but you have to promise to keep him safe. Just putting him in this catch-22 with the other guy. And I can't, I cannot pull back what I was thinking about in the movie. It's driving me nuts.
Well, what, I tell you what you could do.
So,
we can
but anyway,
like,
we'll keep going. We'll keep going. I don't want to get stuck at that point.
No, that's true. But what I'm saying is the good thing about cross take is you've got to think it, right? So if it occurs to you in between now and actually doing the episode,
I can
just
put
play
it
the theme tune. Put it
put
in.
Bob,
it didn't occur to me. Bugger.
And it's not.
Also, she's appealing to his humanity in the house. Nobody up to that point in the whole movie,
right?
Up to except maybe Pop, I guess, but has appealed to him as a human rather than as a cop,
right?
You know, like she doesn't say, you know, you're a cop, you've got to follow the rules,
right?
You know, it's like promise me,
right?
Be, you know, she appeals to his humanity,
right?
And that he becomes like softened. The longer the, you know, the chase goes on, this one day, it's all it is a day.
Right.
The longer this one day goes on, the more he's softened, and you know his rage is like sucked out of him,
right.
And it's replaced by, towards her, anyway, like tenderness, like a certain, you know, like that desire to take care of somebody and to look after them.
Right, but not in a way where. Like, I don't think he ever sees her as helpless.
No.
And I like that about it. And I don't think that... And I think that he also finds it refreshing that he's in a scenario where... if he does it right and if he plays it right, he can actually do some good. And he can actually...
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Put something away. And put someone away. And... Instead of killing him is the easy route.
Yeah.
Finding him and killing him is the easy route. And it's also not a line that we know he's crossed up until that point. We don't know that he's gone around killing people.
No.
We know that he's been beating a few people up. We don't know that he's ever
killed
them.
Yeah, and even that, like, I mean, in terms of the rules of whatever this city is and the type of police department it is, they seem to be pretty... I mean, everybody seems to be pretty upset by the fact that he's going too far beating up suspects.
Right.
And they what they appear to be, more than anything actually, is concerned for him.
Right.
Like, they're not like, you know, listen, you know, you get results, and you're a loose cannon, you know, McBain or whatever. It's not right. That. It's like, we're worried about you.
Right.
You know, because we can't work with this.
Right.
And there's that really pleasingly pragmatic thing of the captain saying, you know, what good's information if you beat it out of a guy and it gets thrown out of court?
Right.
You know.
But there's also like a really interesting scene with the captain.
Yeah, with him eating.
Where he's sat in a restaurant.
Breakfast as
breakfast,
well, right?
But he's eating like a whole bunch of food, like literally a fat cat.
A basket.
At a...
And there's like peas, and you go, what's this guy having for breakfast, man?
Right, and he comes in, and it's literally like... It's this weird comment on hierarchy that doesn't quite fit in the movie.
No, it seems to me more like...
Because why is it trying to say that, oh, the captain, like, is just a big, fat desk jockey who eats a lot of food?
I tell you what it is. I tell you what it reminds me of.
That doesn't really play into his...
It reminds me of...
Is that his justification? Is that his, like, well, I'm still... At least I'm still walking the beat and putting people away. Like, is that his...
I don't think it's that. I think it's a trope that I think connotes, when it's used, and it is usually used in film novels, it's the idea that, first of all, it makes the detective, whoever's coming in, not that important.
Right.
Because it's like, this is so not important, I can deal with this while I'm eating lunch. In other words, when he's putting together his calendar for the day, you know, I'm going to see this guy, then I'm going to see that guy, then I'm going to take that meeting, then I'm going to have some lunch. You know, send him in then. That, you know, it's only going to take a few minutes. So it's
right.
Like, you're not important. And the other thing is, you're saying that you're drawing a contrast between the relative success that each character has made in their lives, right? He scrapes out food into a bin and then throws the plates in a sink. Like, that's what the Robert Ryan character does right at the beginning. And here's a guy who's eating in a 5-star restaurant, ordering whatever he likes, and it's brought to him, and he's eating whatever he fat, you know, whatever takes fat. So there's that thing of like...
But it also makes you feel... But that's
take my advice, right? Because look at how I'm doing. Like, it's,
right.
It's a little part of it.
And I think that there is...
A little
is,
bit decadent, you know?
I think there's
like, do you really want to end up like me? If you keep going down this course, at best, even if you rein in your temper and you become the best cop ever, you'll just be a fat guy in a booth eating peas. If that's all you want,
right.
Go for your life. But that's what's waiting.
But I also think that, like I said before, his scenario is self-imposed. So he's living with the barest minimum, you know, shuffling about in the same suit and coat, scraping stuff into a bin, not having any connections with anyone. It's all self-imposed.
Mm.
And maybe one of the things that he uses to, like, justify that is that, well, at least I'm not this fat guy sat there shoveling food into my mouth. I'm lean, I'm on the streets, I'm...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm not a desktop.
There's a fair amount of self-delusion at the beginning. Like, he's got... He's... You know, the pop's watching a Western with his kids. He's hanging out with... His other partner's hanging out with his wife. And he's reading through, like, the criminal profiles.
Yeah.
You know, he's, like, swatting up. Is it?
Right.
Like, initially, at the beginning, he looks like, I'm the serious police. Like, right. It looks like, well, they're just, like, lazy bums or whatever. And I'm, you know, I'm going to be, like, the hard-working cop, yeah, or whatever.
But no, so there's, but there is this feeling towards the end that, like, it's a no-win situation. I know, there's a no-win situation in the sense that she's probably making him promise something he can't promise. There's no real way to rein in the father. And in fact, the father does, like, balls it up for everybody. When he confronts the boy... Like, the big revelation is that he's a boy. Like, he's a teenager at best. Yeah. He's not like a...
He's like 14, 15,
he's not
maybe.
Like a damaged adult. He's like a teenager. He's a child. And I think that adds even more to the softening of him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not like...
Well, there's... Right at the end, when, you know, it all goes down, the father's fury disappears immediately.
Immediately he realizes
becomes he becomes a father again.
Yeah.
Weirdly. It's like given back to him.
Yeah. So I don't feel at all in the last 45 minutes that I've at all explained or...
No, I think we did okay. We explored...
No, I don't think I have, because I really, really, really liked the film. I liked the film that it was doing. It's not... It's the reason why I think it's low budget is it's shot very workmanlike, and it's very pedestrian, and it very the sets and everything, and it's not it feels very B movie ish in its what it's made and how it's made, and you can't say that everyone in it is a phenomenal actor either. There are quite a few what strike me as people who were maybe hired because of how they looked than necessarily how great they are at acting, because everyone looks really good. Like, everyone looks the business,
yeah,
and very authentic, but you can't say that any of them apart from, like, the two leads are, like, particularly amazing actors. But the two leads are charismatic as all hell. Ida Lupino's amazing, and he's amazing. And I feel like what's interesting is the ending was earned. Like, the ending felt...
Yeah, even though it was actually really quick, it's just that him leaving her big, like she wanted, and driving back to the city, and they just fade, like, the mountains he's driving through into, like, the lights of the city. And then he just turns around.
Yeah.
And you feel like...
But you don't even see him turn around.
Yeah, you don't, that's true. You just see him come... You just see the house again, I suppose. But you're right. It doesn't feel... Like, any other film would, like, stick a scene in at the city where he... You know, he goes through again and he realises where he belongs with her. But they... whoever made him, he's like, we don't need it.
Well, that's what I mean.
They've earned it up to this point.
It's...
Let's just give it to him.
It's...
He has to walk away because if he stays...
It's based on a novel. It's written a lot like a play. Certainly the scenes, yeah, in the house are all written very much like a play. And it's not concerned with... I mean, it was barely an hour and a half. It's not concerned...
Yeah, it was about 80 minutes, I think.
Yeah, it's not concerned in padding out the thing with, like, erroneous scenes it doesn't need. But what is interesting about it is that it did take its time in the beginning. Like, it showed you enough in the beginning that you got a full sense of his life. Because I think in a weird
without
way...
Without weirdly necessarily generating... I mean, up to the point that before he meets her, he hasn't generated an awful lot of sympathy for himself.
No, and
as
in fact,
like a lead character.
The opening sequence the only thing they do that I suppose makes him a little more justified is that they make it a cop killing. He's trying to find someone accused of a cop killing. And even in modern movies, that's become a cliche where, like, well, if it's a cop killing, then all niceties are off the table and we're going to just go crazy about it. You know what I mean? Like, that's...
Although, interesting that nobody else shares that.
No.
If anything, like, the captain has to turn up at the squad room at the beginning of the movie and goes, do I need to remind you there's a cop killer wandering around out there? And they're all like, yeah. You know, right. Like, that nobody's like, yeah, come on, man.
Except him. Right, which are, because I think he finds a weird nobility in, like being principled.
If you just directly compare what he does that evening with what his partners do, he finds the information that leads to the guy that will take him to the cop killer.
Right.
One partner sits in a car and asks for an ice cream sundae and fancies flirting with the waitress. And his other partner is a bit bothered by his shoulders. He goes to see the doctor.
And then goes
home.
He rubs
a bit of liniment on it and goes home. Yeah. Like, this is the... I mean, it may well be a crime-ridden city, but it's a crime-ridden city policed by, do you know what I mean, a squad, you know, less than... It's not...
Which I think is where... That's the other thing. He's beaten himself down over the last 11 years trying to be the cop that he thinks everyone should be. And he feels like it all falls on his shoulders.
That's not specifically said, but I think you're right, actually. Yeah.
No, but I think it's said in the opening shots of, like...
I agree. I'm just saying no one comes out... Because a lot of it is made explicit. Like, that the speech that the Pops gives to him in the alley is, like... No one gave him that speech in the book. It's like a neat summary of what that part of the movie is meant to be for.
Right.
And I think you're right about
that. It's interesting, because if you had made this movie... Post all the cliche-ridden films where all cops are like, oh, there's a cop killer, so we're all going to band together until we find the person and kill them.
Right.
You would be like, oh, this is deconstructing the cliche and breaking down the walls and all the rest of it.
It feels almost like a 90s movie.
Right.
You know, it feels like the movie where the guy that's a bit too brutal and he gets sent on a case.
Right.
Like, up in like a remote...
But what's interesting
is... Woodsy part of the world where he falls in love with a blind woman and... You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of...
Yeah, again, I don't know a lot about film noir, but, like, this is beginning of the 50s. Most of the
none of them was 40s.
Most of the Bogart stuff and all that is all 30s and 40s.
There are some, but it's a bit...
And I wonder if this isn't a reaction to, like, the 15 years of movies that come before. Like, I feel like if this was made in... 99 or early 2000, it would be a reaction to the cop dramas and the thrillers of the late 80s, 90s.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe this is a reaction to... Well, let's talk about the cops that we tend to idolize in movies, or the people we tend to idolize are these hard-nosed people with no humanity... Well, no human... long-term human connection.
Yeah.
You know, who have to get their man and da 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 da. But let's look at that for a minute. Is that really who we want to idolize? And is that really who we need to become? And
I wonder if, and I don't know this for sure.
In fact, the only thing that the ending doesn't quite, like, it's a great ending because he realizes, yes, there's something more that I could be doing, and there's something that maybe is genuinely noble rather than whatever ideas of nobility I have in my head. But almost the perfect ending would be him finally realizing what it takes to be an actually good cop, letting someone into his life.
But what I'm wondering is, because he says at some point, I don't know how to do anything else, right? But there's that thing, and again, I don't know, and I don't want to get into the whole, you know, captain speculation.
Yeah.
But the thing about him being, like, they throw that stuff in about him being a high school athlete, right?
Right.
And he throws the, you know, paper with the kid, and then he goes up and looks at his, you know, his trophies. And I wonder whether, like, obviously, you know, there is that thing that happens in movies where guy who's like the high school, you know, running quarterback or whatever, you know, goes to the big city and kind of gets lost a bit and yearns for that feeling of belonging again. Particularly like in a small town or whatever, but like that it's, he realizes it's not just the fact that he was a star quarterback that he misses, but that he misses being in that environment and being in that kind of a place. And I wonder whether there's not a bit more explicit in the book the idea that it's maybe not just about her but also about leaving the city.
Right.
The city is the grey area and the small town, you know, with these people who are real people, you know, who are complicated. They're not just like, you know, none of them are like, oh, say, we're all real friendly here. It's like he only, you know, he's only met like a complete nutter who wants to, you know, understandably kill the bloke that's done in his daughter, who then, when that finally happens, you know, shows incredible tenderness towards
right.
the guy. Then there's, you know, the bad guy himself, who is this, you know, clearly mentally ill, but not without kindness, you know, like fills the sister's house deliberately with unique sculptures that allow her to move around. You know, he's not ungrateful for what she's done, and she's given up the site to look after a kid who is obviously mentally ill. So they're, you know, real complicated people, but it's smaller and maybe it's easier for him to navigate. But something of like, he longs for the simplicity of the times when he was like the star athlete.
Yeah.
I think is maybe something that's happening in that ending that's a bit lost in the 80 minute let's get to the chase thing.
But I also think that it's wonderfully played and actually a genuinely romantic ending. There is a release when it happens.
Do they kiss, or is it just the hands?
No, they kiss.
Because I felt like when she's coming down the stairs, he holds her hand out to her, and she holds her hand out like almost instinctively because she can't see.
Right.
And they reach each other, and then the shot of their hands holding each other is really something.
Yeah.
They could have faded. I mean, I know it's Hollywood, so they've got to end with Hollywood in the 50s has got to end with them kissing. Right. They didn't need to. They could have just ended on the hands and faded out to the mountain. Because it's the other thing, like, the last shot is not of them kissing it at the end, like, you know, some movies are. It's of the mountains and the snow and the, you know what I mean? It's not just them, it's them in this place.
Yeah.
So I think that's a part of it.
Yeah. But it's, yeah, it's...
The city is not romanticised, is it?
No.
At all.
No, not at all. Yeah, it's a really, like, there's so much going on.
There is.
There's so much going on.
I didn't feel like I was being. Film noirs are like really entertaining because they're snappy and they're funny and they're exciting and they're cool. And there's, you know, they're like the blockbusters, as it were, of their day. But this feels more like one of those. It feels like one of those 80s, late 80s cop thrillers. Where there's more going on there. Like when they, you know, they end up on a Native American reservation or whatever, that idea of like taking a cop out and putting them into a strange land and seeing what happens. And it's kind of a serious exploration of what it is to be human, what it is to be an American, what it, you know, those kind of that kind of thing.
Yeah, it was really great.
Well, thanks, man.
Really enjoyed it. It was fantastic.
And hopefully you'll be able to put cross take, bonus cross take on the end.
Yeah, no, actually I think we covered it.
Cool. Awesome.
I'm not feeling like there's stuff left to say.
No, I really, if you get a chance to see On Dangerous Ground, especially if it comes on the big screen, which again, that was another thing about it, I didn't feel alienated from it at all, even though it was like a bit of a scratch. I mean, actually it was in pretty good nick, but I don't know. Sometimes I can feel a little bit alienated from 40s movies because they are very stylized, the music and the costume, and it's, you know, it's whatever at this point, 60, nearly 70 years old, but it was really immediate. I felt a real connection to the people in it. So if you get a chance to see it, definitely go see it.
And again, one of those things where all the same shit that's going on today, it was going on 70 years ago. And the same questions, the same stories, the same humanity, the same thing. Only somewhere along the line we forgot how to make good movies about it.
Very true.
And you have to go back to 1951 to find a good movie about it.
But fortunately they are out there. They are out there. So you go find it.
To be found. So everyone check it out if you see it. And thanks again, Jim Wallace.
Thank you very much for having me. And thank you to Charles H. Nelson.
Riley.
And Micah Johnson. Riley. Wait.
No, I'm just... Because there's that... Nelson Riley. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Nelson Riley.
Charles H. Nelson.
Charles H. Nelson and Micah Johnson for being all round good eggs.
Yes.
and Chris Leatherman.
And I just ate eggs.
You pay for those eggs. Charles H. Nelson and Michael Johnson.
And Chris Leatherman.
Right.
You should end with that noise.
In a white town in the end.
Sorta.
Flew in on a plane of flamingo.
Sorta.
Waiting for his
water wings to
hit the ground. Trundled home in a limo.
Porter.
Rushing on the endless run from the court of gods whose adventures
never ever
hang around.
Yeah, but there's something in their rainy day
smile. That girl of mine.
Tiny lines on lips that read.
Everything's fine.
More or less. And I guess. Right now.
Anything's worth trying. Post our flowers in the ground
or burn us.
Nice to see so many turn up. The barbershop trio sang a lovely melody. I hope we're not awake when they turn on the furnace. I wonder what a diamond teeth will earn us. I suppose it's something else that we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, but there's something in a rainy day
smile. That girl of mine.
Tiny lines on lips that read.
Everything's fine.
More or less.
And I guess.
Right now.
Anything's worth trying.